riding into the paranormal.
It is going to be a hoedown on the program tonight. Boy, just a week off, and I already missed the microphone, so I'm going to hog it tonight. At least for this first part of the program, but I want to hear from you as always. 818-672-6865 is the number. Everybody's got a phone, so you can pull it out, and it'll be a free call. 818-672-6865. You can Skype into Paranormal. I do want to hear from you, but tonight it is going to be a hoedown. That's right. We're going to be, well, talking about everything from the ghosts of country music to haunted happenings on college campuses. I mean, how much spookier can it get? And we've got a hell of a paranormal news each hour with John Jeter tonight, bottom of the hour. Earth-shattering news from NASA, of course. We've got stories of soldiers actually being zapped by aliens. And sorry, all of you Bigfoot believers, we're going to give you a big old buzzkill on the Bigfoot front tonight. Also, preparing for the apocalypse, the world's first hover bike, and stories of mass demonic possession, all in the news tonight with John Jeter. That's at the bottom of the hour in Paranormal News. But of course, the world right now, is there really any bigger story, friends, than what played out on television last Sunday night? Are any Walking Dead fans among us? Did you see the UFO? I don't know. I don't know what to say, friends. Because I watched that program, and it was a very, very sick and twisted episode this past Sunday night involving one of the most insane zombies we've seen to date on that program. But I don't know about a UFO. I mean, there was a picture. I haven't watched the episode back and looked for this UFO. I have seen a picture of it. I don't know if that makes it actual proof that it was a UFO or not. Certainly, if there was something flying in the background. Yes, it is an unidentified flying object. I know the obvious definition of that. But come on. I think they're making a whole bunch of nothing out of this. That's just my honest proof. But I don't know. Did you see the UFO on The Walking Dead last Sunday night? The show all about the zombie apocalypse. In fact, they will appreciate you Walking Dead fans. One of the stories that we've got in the newscast tonight with John Jeter. But the freak out over the UFO on The Walking Dead, I think probably is is the top thing that people are talking about. I mean, are they? I don't know. At least among the paranormal world, it seemed to be, you know, there's obviously all sorts of stories that get posted day in and day out, a lot of them over and over and over again. And I saw this one posted many times over by many different organizations. So if you saw the UFO on The Walking Dead last Sunday night, if you think that they're trying to send us a message, I'd be interested in your take. You can pull up your phone, dial 818-672-6865. That number is also at paranormalradio.com. Or you can Skype into the program. You can click the Skype button on the website as well. Because I didn't see it. Now I can say that you know, I work long and hard during the week, and there are some times that when it comes to watching a program, I do not make it all the way through. I mean, I'm okay to admit that. I sometimes nod off, and I have to go back and watch things two or three or four times. And I'm forgetful, and it's just the nature of the beast. But here's the thing. I watched the episode twice, actually, in that sense. I watched it Sunday night, and to the point that I fell asleep. And then I went back on Monday, and I rewound to the last point I remember, and I watched it from that point forward. And I did not see a UFO. Now, that's just me. If you saw the UFO, I'd be interested in your take. if you think it's just people making a whole bunch of nothing. Well, we should be used to that in the paranormal realm. In fact, there was this story that put this certain group of individuals in the light. And since it's already out there and there's a story that will take you right to it, I guess I don't really have a problem bringing it up, but it just goes to show that not everything that you see is actually real. And it's very disappointing that there are people out there who spread fake news. You say, what? Yeah, there is news that is perpetuated and perpetrated and propaganded and whatever other prop you want to use all around the internet. And it's there every single day. It is retweeted. It is shared over and over and over ad nauseum, in fact. And there is not a single part of it that is true. Pick a headline. It's sad. And with the sponsored stuff out there, the stuff that you actually think is news, and come to find out it's, well, all it is just hype. And it's just trying to get you to click on something because they want your money. Well, of course they do. And they're doing a good job of it. But nonetheless, these people who spread these falsehoods and intentionally do it, you know, everybody's wrong in their lifetime. I've got on this store on the air with stories before, very few times. In fact, only one that can come to memory right away. And I went on with this story, and it happened to be about a Bigfoot sighting, actually. And after I went off the air, I found out that it was absolutely bogus. There was nothing to it. And I felt really bad about it. But yet, if we had to triple check what we would think had already been done in a story that was printed, you know, there wouldn't really be any fun stuff to talk about because we would have to say, well, that's cool, you know, and here it is in front of me. But now I have to put it through the cheese grater, so to speak, and I have to go through, you know, extensive diagnosis to figure out whether or not this is actually provable. I mean, if you had to do that to every single story, there's stuff that wouldn't get any light of day. We would be so dumb. So kudos to those who can actually think outside the box and take things with a grain of salt, but also use the information that is presented to them and do their own thinking with it. If you can do your own thinking with the stuff you digest, you are certainly ahead of the game, friends. But the people who perpetuate the falsehoods that suck people in, get people to believe that what they're seeing is the real deal, and then they just, you know, they rake people over the coals for money. Those are the ones that really get me. This case right here happens to be a group of individuals. Or maybe it's just one person. But they have a YouTube channel. And they almost have 1 million subscribers. So, I mean, kudos to them. If I could get 1 million people listening to me every week, or 785,000 as they have, I would be absolutely thrilled. And so on one hand, I'm sitting down praising them. Congratulations for being able to achieve such a milestone that you can literally post a couple of YouTube videos and make a living. They make more in a day than most people will make in a 2-week pay period. So you imagine what you go to work, you work 40 hours a week, 80 hours a pay period, and you're pulling home what these people are pulling home in one single day of posting this junk online. They've got all these subscribers who are playing their videos, who are sharing their videos, people believe it to be true. And they are just raking in the money. They're raking in the money on primarily the advertising, the stuff that pops up while you're watching the video. So while you say, well, I'm not really so, you're watching the video and watching their fake news is putting money in their pocket. So if you want to stop these people from being able to make more than you probably make, than I probably make, and your next door neighbor makes in a single freaking day, then you got to stop watching this junk. There's just no other way around it. You got to stop watching it. It's garbage. It's absolute hullabaloo. Yeah, I'm a little irritated, but I guess I'll get over it very, very quickly. We do have Matt Swain joining us coming up here in not too long. John Jeter, Paranormal News, is also on the way at the bottom of the hour. So from the Walking Dead UFO freakout to my freakout over fake news, you know, there was this other story that happened to be perpetrated on the internet within the past week. It was my birthday last week. And I was off the air, but there came a story across my desk that got me interested, and I said, And it was involving the celebrity Johnny Depp. We know who he is. And so this individual was involved in a story that turned out to be, well, it turned out to be real. It just happened to be like, I don't know, 2 years old. And here it came up on the internet once again in the past week, as if it was something that was happening in the now. And they even said recently, that recently Johnny Depp claimed that he was attacked by a chupacabra and fought with it for hours before managing to somehow get it in a suitcase and throw it off the 23rd floor of a building. Of course, if a chupacabra is something that has never actually been proven to exist, something that's between a dog and a who knows what. But here's Johnny Depp 2 years ago, who actually did talk to reporters, because I was pulling up the video of this incident and I'm thinking, okay, well, here's Johnny Depp talking about a chupacabra attack in 2015. What are the chances that it happened again? Well, they're few and far between. They didn't happen again. It didn't happen again. And so this stuff is out there. It's everywhere you look, friends. It is infiltrating society, and it is disgusting. It is disgusting that people are just reposting garbage, stuff that's not true. In the case of the last story, in the case of this story, stuff that is so old it stinks like something you might bring in from outside on the bottom of your shoe. 818-672-6865, 818-672-6865 is the call-in number. You call in now, you'll talk with me. Bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by Matt Swain, talking about the ghosts of country music. It's going to be a hoedown tonight, I promised you that at the top of the hour. And so it's going to get that way here very, very quickly with Matt Swain at the bottom of the hour. But you know, I told Matt that we were going to bring him on at the bottom of the hour because I had so much to talk about here in this first segment, and that's darn true. There is a very, very minority of individuals out there who believe in a theory that the Earth is not round. It is not a sphere, or it is not a globe like we are taught in school and brought up in life. That it is not round, but rather that it is flat. Well, here's a theory that was actually brought up by an NBA star, a well-known NBA, National Basketball Association, that's a professional basketball athlete, by the name of Kyrie Irving. He plays for the reigning champion Cleveland Cavaliers. And before an All-Star game, and that included absolutely zero defense and almost a combined 400 point. You heard that, friends, right? Kyrie Irving was talking about the fact that even though they play with a basketball, which is a round object that they bounce on the floor and try not to bounce off their foot out of bounds or have the other player take away from them and eventually put that ball in the basket for points. Well, Kyrie Irving says even though balls are round in which they play with, that somehow the earth is flat. So there's kind of a very, very contradicting thought, if you ask me, that something can be round, but yet something very similar can be completely opposite. So we're not going to get into a debate here tonight on whether the earth is flat or whether the earth is round, because there's never enough time in the day, no matter how long you have, because there's always somebody who wants to give their opinion. And trust me, those are good programs, and I'm going to have a program on that coming up very quickly here on the program, whether or not the earth is flat or whether the earth is round. Of course, in the coming weeks on the show, next week is my 200th episode, and Preston Dennett is here. He's a well-known authority on ufology, extraterrestrial topics as well, and he's going to detail more true accounts of contact next week on the program. The week after, March 11th, the psychic lawyer Mark Anthony will join me, and we're going to be talking all about the afterlife. And then my good friend Dr. Lynn Kitai on March 18th is here as we mark the 20th anniversary of the infamous Phoenix Lights incident, March 1997, in fact. She is the foremost authority on the subject, and Dr. Kitai will be here to share her insights. That is something you will not want to miss here on the program. That's what's coming up in the next couple of weeks. So when we come back after the bottom of the hour news with John Jeter, in which he has got some crazy, crazy, crazy stories tonight, we're going to be joined by Matt Swain, and we're going to be getting into the topic of haunted legends of country music. That's right. And then later on, he is a research writer at Penn State University, and we're going to be speaking with him about haunted campuses as well. And so that's the program tonight. Of course, you're welcome to join the show at any time, 818-672-6865. That's 818-672-6865. And you can Skype the program at Into Parabnormal. There's also a very interesting thing going on. You know, the bumblebees have been dying for quite some time. And bumblebees are very, very important to the human race surviving in many different ways. Obviously, we need their pollination. And here's a thought to consider. There is a report that one of the reasons that bumblebees are dying off is because they are simply too fat to mate, which means they cannot have any offspring. There was a story on the news last night about bees that were actually trained to take an object to a certain point. And so it's very, very fascinating that they could actually have some sort of consciousness that we could be tapping into. But there's a thought. Bumblebees are dying out because they are too fat to mate. And with our bumblebee die-off, there is a thought about pollination drones that could help replace the mass die-off of bees, and that these drones could be used to do the pollination, maybe at such a level or even a higher level than the bees that we have currently. You know, is very interesting. When we come back, the ghosts of country music We'll jab out to the haunted hotspots, the creepy curses, and the celebrity spirits of country western music with Matt Swain. That's coming up next from Portland, Oregon tonight. I'm Jeremy Scott in the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon. We'll be back.
Paranormal News, I'm John Jeter. And now, some earth-shattering news from NASA.
For me, it's mind-blowing.
The first ever known finding of a system of seven Earth-sized planets orbiting a single star was revealed this week. The Spitzer Space Telescope discovered three of them within the habitable zone of the constellation Aquarius in the exoplanet system known as TRAPPIST-1. It is located 40 light-years away. Scientists say all the planets are capable of holding water, and where there's water, there could be life. What is it about October and the apocalypse?
Apocalypse means to destroy this world.
Well, Planet X is rumored to be getting ready to hit us. And now the state legislature in Illinois has declared October as Zombie Preparedness Month. This act is intended to motivate state agencies and you and I to prepare for the inevitable, man, or any natural disaster or attack for that matter. The CDC's zombie preparedness plan has been in place for years now. And just weeks ago, Jeremy talked about the 1% stocking up on apocalypse insurance. Are the end of days really upon us? Hunting Bigfoot is a real thing. We all know Jeremy's take on that.
Before you kill Bigfoot, you actually have to find Bigfoot.
But spending your tax dollars on such tomfoolery? Well, forget about it, says a senator from New Mexico. George Munoz wants to make it illegal for public funds to be spent hunting for such mythical creatures. Mythical? He has drafted a bill in response to Dr. Christopher Dyer, a University of New Mexico professor who charged $7,000 to the university for a conference in which he led people into the desert in search of Bigfoot.
Did you see Bigfoot?
No, but we looked at habitat. We didn't see it.
It's sad that we have to do this, that UNM doesn't have the ethics to stop this.
After all is said and done, no Bigfoot. And $7,000 down the drain. I'm John Jeter. Connect with tonight's news at ParanormalRadio.com.
Welcome to Into the Paranormal. Journalist Matt Swain joining me now. His website, MattSwain.com. He's author of Ghosts of Country Music, Tales of Haunted Honky Tonks and Legendary Spectras. He's a journalist balancing skepticism with an open mind, telling stories of ghost lore, the paranormal, and the supernatural. He's a research writer at Penn State University, a reporter, a music reviewer, and author of the Antimatter column for Omni Reboot, currently at 5 books. We're going to be discussing Ghosts of Country Music tonight in addition to his book about America's haunted universities, Ghosts That Roam, Hallowed Halls, and his website is MattSwain.com, S-W-A-N, or A-Y-N-E.com, that is, MattSwain.com. And, of course, it's linked up at ParanormalRadio.com. Good evening, Matt.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. What have you been up to of late?
Still writing a lot, trying to work on another project. The next one might be about World War II.
Fantastic. Are you still going to be writing a book at some point about music and about jazz music, or have you done that already?
You are actually the second person who's asked me that just this week, as a matter of fact. And I think it's something that I could look into for sure. There are a number of stories, especially when you start talking about you know, the speakeasies and the jazz age, there are tons of ghost stories that surround that. And as I'll probably talk a lot about this evening, there's just something special about music that brings out the spiritual and the supernatural.
And you have also written a book about the ghosts of rock and roll as well.
I have, yeah. That was the last book that I wrote. And The Ghosts of Country Music is really, in some ways, a sequel to that. And it's kind of opened up my eyes a little bit to this idea that there's something supernatural about music. So it was sort of a natural next project for me. And during my research about the haunted rock and roll stories, I came across a few stories about country music stars, and I thought, you know, I wonder if there's enough for a book, and it turns out there is.
Did you have a paranormal experience in childhood, Matt?
Well, my birth was sort of paranormal. I was born on Halloween, so that set the tone for me. As far as encounters with the supernatural, I'm always very careful on how I phrase this. But, you know, throughout my life, I have experienced things that I would consider, I guess I consider it weird, maybe not supernatural or paranormal, that to me, I have a very high bar that's set for something like that. But I've certainly had things that are hard to explain through natural means, or that occurred so often that it rose to the level that it went above coincidence. And also, just as part of this, I can't say it's a job, it's more of a hobby, but collecting stories about the paranormal, I talked to literally hundreds of people who have had encounters with what they consider the paranormal or the supernatural. And in a lot of cases, it's, you know, these people are very credible, believable. In a lot of cases, it's changed their lives, and it's changed, in some cases, it's taken people who are really diehard skeptics, if not cynics, into believers. And so I consider those encounters pretty valid. So I still keep an open mind about this subject. But when I talk about my own personal experiences, I can't say that I've had anything paranormal happen to me.
So why write about this stuff, Matt?
Well, I guess for me, the point of not believing this kind of idea, where when I write these stories, on some cases, I start out thinking, wow, I really believe this story. 2 minutes later, I'm a skeptic, and then by the end of the story, I'm back to being a believer again. I think there's a tension that drives narratives of these stories, of especially of ghost stories. But the other thing that I find about ghost stories, and whether you believe in ghosts or not, isn't really the question that I'm looking at. What I really believe is that ghost stories are real social facts. You can't doubt that ghost stories exist, and they exist for a reason. Actually, they exist for a lot of different reasons. And so I think collecting these stories plays a role in that. For one thing, it keeps these stories of these people alive. You know, when we talk about Hank Williams, we talk about the wonderful voice of Patsy Cline. You know, maybe there is some reason for these ghost stories to exist, and it might just be that we get a chance to talk about them and review their lives again. So even if you don't believe in ghost stories, the fact that these ghost stories exist and that they are important, they're part of our culture, and I think they're valid just for that reason alone.
Matt Swain, my guest tonight, and we're talking about the ghosts of country music. So, Matt, what is it with the paranormal and country music that that got you writing about the tie-in?
So when I started writing Haunted Rock and Roll, and just to give you a little background about that, I had just finished America's Haunted University, and I was looking for another project to work on, and I pitched this idea to my acquisitions editor with really just the idea that I had a couple stories in mind. You know, I knew that the ghost of Elvis was seen. I heard stories about Jim Morrison actually becoming a ghost, and I knew the stories from Led Zeppelin because I read Gary Patterson's book. So I just had that in the back of my mind. But then when I researched it, when I got into it, I found dozens of stories, either about rock stars who became ghosts, or rock stars who have seen ghosts, or just some of the kind of creepy occult stuff that went on with rock and roll, whether it's the 27 Club this tendency of rock stars to die at the age of 27, as well as the Buddy Holly curse. So I found this just underlying supernatural theme throughout rock and roll history. And when I walked away from that project, I thought there is just something spiritual and supernatural about rock and roll. And then I started researching the Country Ghost Storybook, and I found similar, in ways similar, but in ways a little different. But what I found was volume-wise, the number of ghost stories that surround country music superstars or country music superstars who have had supernatural encounters was equal to the rock and roll genre. So my ideas sort of changed now. And I look at music itself as being really kind of a spiritual, supernatural technology, a technology that connects us to the spirit world. And, you know, as proof of this, if you look at any religion or any form of spirituality, most of them, if not all, revolve around that it somehow incorporate music into the worship service itself, whether it's Bach fugues, whether it's drumming and for shamans, whether it's hymns or gospel music, all of those forms, or even chanting, all of those religions rely on music to spiritual ends. So that's why I think this is a kind of interesting for me as both a music fan and as a fan of ghost stories and ghost lore. It all sort of comes together in these stories about ghosts and country music and rock and roll.
So you do think that artists and musicians are more spiritually aware?
Yes, I do. And one of the reasons I think that is I've done two books on musicians and the supernatural. And I've yet to start work on, you know, the accountants, ghost stories of accountants or, you know, haunted marketing representatives. So I think there is something spiritual, and I'll actually go a little beyond this. I think there's something spiritual about artists, but musicians right now, and I haven't looked into the ghost stories or the supernatural aspects of artists or actors. But certainly those stories do come up when you talk about haunted theaters, haunted auditoriums. There just seems to be some type of deep connection between the act of creation, whether it's music or art, and supernatural experiences. The other thing I find is that I think music, the fans of music have an affinity for the supernatural. And that's why I think these ghost stories, number one, are experienced, but number two, as someone who likes folklore and ghost lore, I think that affinity for the supernatural is probably one of the reasons these stories are sticking around for decades. In the case of Rhyme and Auditorium, you know, close to 100 years of ghost stories.
What is your favorite country music ghost story?
I have a bunch. I kind of like to tell ghost stories about the Ryman. I find the Ryman sort of exemplifies some of the things I was just talking about, because the Ryman Auditorium, and I'm not sure everyone knows this, but the Ryman Auditorium was built by a gentleman named Captain Thomas Ryman. And Thomas Ryman, in his early days, was kind of a bad figure. He was involved in gambling. He was involved in owning bars and maybe even a few brothels. And at one point, a preacher came into Nashville and was, I guess he was bleeding away some of Captain Ryman's best customers, and he was converting them to Christianity. And so apparently Captain Ryman went to one of these revival meetings that this preacher was going to, was having, and his idea was probably to intimidate the preacher or to heckle him, but he ended up becoming converted. And he turned – he built Ryman Auditorium originally It was a place for worship and a place for spiritual music, not for secular music. And so over the years, and it's one of the reasons why we consider the Ryman the mother church of country music. But after Captain Ryman passed on, the secular music was started to play there. And apparently the ghost of Thomas Ryman didn't like it so much. And there's one story in the book where a act is playing on stage. It's a secular act, and it's also kind of on the saucy side. And apparently the ghost of Thomas Ryman didn't like it so much. So the audience members said they heard what started out was sort of a banging. It grew louder and louder. And eventually the hall was filled with the sound of what they almost considered explosions. And it was so loud it drowned out the music on stage. And so a lot of people that were there and heard that said that that was Captain Ryman basically scuttling the act and causing them to take a quick exit.
So the Ryman Theater, but another famous spot, we've heard a lot about Bobby Mackey's World. That's a famous paranormal spot. A lot of folks investigate there.
Yeah, that is probably one of the hottest paranormal hotspots that I found. And there was literally pages and pages. Books were written about this haunting that I drew on for the book. And it's interesting for me on a couple different levels. Number one, you know, I've said that there are similarities between the haunted rock and roll and the ghost of country music, mainly in the volume. But there are a lot of differences, and one of the differences, the ghost stories of country music tend to stay a little closer to the traditional ghost story, which is this idea of a person who's alive, they die, and something remains in that area. That's kind of a typical ghost story that is, you know, rooted in a lot of, you know, Christianity and Judeo-Christian ideas on ghosts and the occult. Whereas when you get to haunted rock and roll, you get a whole mixed bag of Eastern spirituality, Celtic magic, and all kinds of stuff. So I find that Bobby Mackey's Music World is one of the stories in country music that it goes beyond that. It is an exception because it really talks about a lot of different types of haunting. In fact, according to the stories that I found and the research that I did, it has just about every type of haunting there is. It has a residual spirit. It has active haunting. It may have demonic haunting and poltergeist activity. So it pretty much has everything. It even has a haunted jukebox, which I found later on is kind of a common ghost story in country music.
Why are jukeboxes haunted, Matt?
I am not really sure, but they do seem to be like haunted objects. And
I've literally seen them eat money before.
I've taken part in some of those rituals. But I think there is, again, if I can use that analogy of supernatural technology, there probably is no other better example of supernatural technology in country music, at least, as the jukebox. So there are a lot of cases in this paranormal lore of country music of jukeboxes playing automatically late at night, jukeboxes playing certain music, certain songs, and the one story about Bobby Mackey's is that the jukebox played and the police were there because they had an alert that there was a break-in, and when they came in the jukebox was playing. And I'm pretty sure this is the right story, but there are cases in Bobby Mackey's where the jukebox wasn't even plugged in and it played a certain song. It played the Anniversary Waltz.
Where's Tootsie's?
Tootsie's is in Nashville, and it's right down the alley from the Ryman. It is one of the one of the kind of sacred spots of country music. And traditionally what would happen is that the artists who played the Ryman would probably go over to Tootsie's for a drink afterwards. And Bess Tootsie, who owned the bar, Tootsie Bess, sorry about that, she actually was almost a guardian angel for some of these acts. She let them play on stage a lot of times, and a lot of famous artists like Kris Kristofferson credit Tootsie's as giving them a start in country music. So it wasn't just the watering hole for the famous. It was also for artists on the way up. And along the way, there's been dozens of ghost stories revolve around both the Ryman, the alley towards Tootsie's, and Tootsie's itself. Some of the ghosts in Tootsie's include Patsy Cline. Hank Williams has reportedly been seen there. And also the Tootsie herself has been seen in the bar.
You say most of Nashville then is haunted, huh?
Nashville, yes. Nashville's haunted, and I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One, you know, it's the center for country music, so you have that supernatural, spiritual aspect of music. But it was also a battlefield. There was the Civil War was fought around and through Nashville. And so it saw a lot of tragedy, and a lot of these ghost stories that you find about Nashville and about some of country music's sacred sites are also intermixed and intermingled with these stories of the Civil War.
Matt Swain, my guest. He is author of Ghosts of Country Music. His website, mattswayne.com, SWAYNE.com. He's also author of America's Haunted Universities. You can find him on Twitter at Matt Swain Books and on Facebook at Matt Swain Writer. Our telephone number is 818-672-6865. That's 818-672-6865. You can also Skype at Into Paranormal. And also the Opryland haunted as well.
Yes, Opryland. And the story about Opryland is that country music grew and grew and grew. And eventually the Grand Ole Opry, which is a radio show, was based in Ryman Auditorium. And eventually the Ryman just couldn't hold it. So they built Opryland with the idea that they would have much better facilities and they could entertain a bigger audience and they could have more technology there for the radio show. What a lot of, and a lot of the country acts, a lot of the country fans at that time weren't really sure about this transition. You know, they liked having the Ryman being the traditional home of the Grand Ole Opry. And I'm sure a lot of fans wanted the ghost to go along, and apparently that happened. There are, again, stories of Hank Williams haunting that area, and there are also some stories about Roy Acuff's home, which is now a museum. And I have to be careful because as I was writing the book, a lot of the places in Opryland had been closed because of flooding, so I'm not really sure about the status. It seemed to change week to week as I was writing it. But one thing's for sure, it did have a haunted legacy almost as equal to that of the Ryman.
My guest, Matt Swain, stick with us. We'll have more with him another half hour or so talking about the ghosts of country music. And then we're going to be talking about America's haunted universities. Stick with us. I'm Jeremy Scott. Into Paranormal rolls on this Saturday night. Rolling on with Matt Swain, author of Ghosts of Country Music. That's more of Johnny Cash. MattSwain.com is his website. We've been talking about some of the haunted sites, many of them in Nashville. Anybody in Nashville listening tonight, 818-672-6865. Give us a shout-out, 818-672-6865. You can Skype into Paranormal. If you're with us with anywhere around the world, love to hear from you tonight. MattSwain.com is his website. You can also find him on Twitter and Facebook. We've got those links on the website. Everything you need to know is right up there tonight. So, Matt, we've been talking about some of those haunted artists. We've been talking about, of course, Johnny Cash, Hank Williams, Patsy Cline, and even Elvis, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is quite a legacy of almost all these famous country acts have either ghost stories attached to them as they passed on, or they actually saw ghosts. And we just played Johnny Cash, his song about Annie Hall, who was kind of a notorious owner. Well, she was the mistress of a hall in Jamaica called Rose Hall. And it was a plantation, and she was known for allegedly killing her husbands, as well as mistreating slaves and killing slaves. And now her mansion in the plantation now in Jamaica is widely reputed to be haunted. And what probably a lot of people don't know is that Johnny Cash had a vacation home not too far away from Rose Hall, which is why he was inspired to write that song. And he had a place called Cinnamon Hill. And that manor also was haunted. And so Johnny Cash has the one of the distinctions of Johnny Cash in my book is that he is an artist who claimed to have seen ghosts, especially in his house in Jamaica. But now there have been paranormal teams who have explored Cinnamon Hill and have said that they have come in contact with both the ghost of Johnny Cash and possibly his wife, June Carter Cash. So it's really a fascinating story. And one of the things that I learned through the research about paranormal and the ghost lore of country music is just how attached Johnny Cash was to the supernatural. And we talked a couple times about how spiritual artists are, and Johnny Cash is definitely an example of that. Prior to writing this book, I considered Johnny a great gospel singer, and you know, I knew his profound faith in Christianity. What I didn't know was that he had a interest in exploring the supernatural and especially spiritualism. He talks about the one ghost story he talks about in my book is that, and I believe it either came from his autobiography or from a biography, and he told the biographer the story, is when he was in his house in Jamaica, they had a dinner party with about six people. And before they sat down for dinner, all of the party participants said that they saw a woman enter the dining room through closed doors and then walk through the party and then out another set of closed doors. And after she left the room, they heard this pounding sound. All of the participants said they saw the same thing, which is one of those cases where in my book, I try to make the distinction between ghost lore, which is folklore based on ghosts and spirits, and actual accounts of ghost sightings or encounters with ghosts. And this seems to be one of those that would be more of an encounter with some type of spirit entity.
Also, stories, Patsy Cline, we played her going out at the bottom of the hour. Give us one involving Patsy Cline, Matt.
There are lots of stories about Patsy Cline. She is allegedly one of the spirits that haunts the Ryman. She's also been seen in Tootsie's, a place I mentioned before. And in that case, there are a few different variations on the story. And some people say that if there's a new country act that plays in Tootsie's and is really well received, that people will see Patsy Cline applauding at the end of the bar, which was supposedly one of her main places where she would stay at the bar. Other people say that, no, that's actually the owner of Tootsie's who is applauding the act. But the story about Patsy Cline that I talk about in the book that I think is probably the most credible is that several of the owners of Patsy's quote-unquote dream house say that that house is haunted. And the house, from most descriptions, probably would not stand up next to the huge mansions that country stars have now and the big estates. It was actually pretty modest for our times, but that back then it was quite the place. And after Patsy died, and unfortunately she didn't get a chance to stay in that house very long because she died in a plane crash, tragically, a few months later. The house was sold a couple times, and a singer stepped up and said that when she owned the place, she considered it haunted and could feel the presence of Patsy Cline there. Later on, a fan of Patsy Cline bought the house, and he said he was initially a skeptic about it, but he started to have experiences in the house. One of the experiences was when he was downstairs, he could hear what he thought sounded like someone walking in high heels upstairs. And initially he blamed his dogs. He had Chihuahuas at the time and thought it was just their nails scraping across the floor. But the one time he heard the noise and noticed that the dogs were right there next to him. He was really trying, the owner was trying to renovate the home to get it back up to standards. And he brought his sisters, who immediately experienced some bizarre paranormal activity, a lot of electromagnetic weirdness, lights turning on and off, and actually the gas fireplace turned on and off by itself. Initially, the owner of the house blamed his sisters for, you know, pulling his leg and making it a prank. But after a lot of this activity happened, you know, by the time I wrote my book, the article that I used as a reference, he had come to the conclusion that there was, you know, something paranormal about the place. And in fact, people talked to one of Patsy's daughter who said that she believed that the house most likely was haunted as well, and wouldn't put it past her mother, you know, to kind of linger around to watch over the place.
Matt Swain, my guest, 818-672-6865. That's 818-672-6865, or you can Skype it into Paranormal. Have you encountered any of these, the ghosts of any of these artists personally, Matt?
No, I have not. I will tell you that I went to Memphis, and I, you know, was in Graceland. I didn't see Elvis, but I will tell you, I felt his presence all over Memphis. And especially when I toured Sun Records, I could really feel, it might just be being in there at the moment and the history of the place. But there is, you know, kind of something special about Sun Records. I looked into it and I could not find any, you know, firsthand accounts or you know, solid leads on ghost lore surrounding Sun Records. But later on, I have talked to people who claim that Sun Records is haunted.
Did anything surprise you about these stories that you researched for this book?
Well, I think I hinted at it, but one of the things that really surprised me was Johnny Cash's involvement in the supernatural and spiritualism. I would classify him as almost like a pioneer ghost hunter. And one of the things I found out was that Johnny Cash and Merle Kilgore, who co-wrote Ring of Fire with June Carter Cash, as well as Johnny Horton, formed this group really of spiritual seekers. And Johnny Horton was a singer who is known mostly for a lot of the saga songs, such as North to Alaska. But that group was deeply involved with spiritualism in contacting spirits. And they connected with one of the enigmatic figures of the book, in my opinion, is J. Bernard Ricks, who I is very mysterious. I think he might have been a postman, but he was also a medium. And what happened was, and just a lot of really strange kind of things happened, but I'll try to take you to one of the fascinating stories is that Johnny Horton was afraid of drunks. And I know that's kind of a bizarre fear to have, but if you're a musician, there are probably a lot of reasons to have that fear. But at one point, he was so afraid to come out because he was convinced a drunk person was going to try to shoot him and kill him in his last performance. And then after the performance went off without a hitch, everyone joked around with it, said, well, you know, you had nothing to worry about. And actually, he was killed by a drunk driver on the way from that gig. And Johnny Cash and Merle Kilgore were crushed because Johnny was such a close friend of theirs. And Johnny Cash allegedly felt even worse because he refused a collect call from Johnny right before he died. But in any event, Johnny and Merle went to Johnny Horton's funeral, and during the funeral, before the funeral, Johnny was talking a lot about how sad he was, but he felt like his friend Johnny Horton was in a better place, and he mentioned the phrase, he believes that where he is at, it is going to be as bright as the day, and after that, they went to the funeral, and Johnny Cash noted that Bernard Hicks was kind of scribbling throughout the funeral service. And later, Johnny Cash said, "I want to see what you were writing during during the service." And Johnny looked down, and there, almost verbatim, was the phrase he used prior to the funeral service, which J. Bernard Ricks would not have had any inkling of what Merle and Johnny were talking about. So there was this case where Johnny Cash used a medium to connect with his friend, and it wasn't the last time that happened. Apparently, Merle Kilgore and Johnny Horton, prior to Johnny's death, had decided that they were going to have their own Houdini experiment, and a lot of people who know something about Houdini gave his wife a code that he would use if he could contact her from beyond the grave. In this case, Merle Kilgore and Johnny Horton decided the phrase would be the drummer is a rummer who can't hold the beat. Never really got that message back from Johnny Horton. Decades later, Merle Kilgore was at a baseball game, I think, and he was brought on the radio station as a special guest. And during the radio broadcast, apparently someone called in, and they were a spiritual this lady was part of a spiritual group, and she had a message for Merle Kilgore. She said that they got a message through during one of their sessions that needed to go to Merle Kilgore, and none of the ladies involved in this circle were country music fans. They didn't even know who Merle Kilgore was until they heard him talking on the radio during the baseball game. And the message was, the drummer is the rummer who can't hold the beat. So those are some of the stories that I was really fascinated about as I went through this book that I had, you know, no inkling. The other one is that Johnny Cash was at Merle Kilgore's studio one afternoon and decided he would start meditating. And allegedly, according to Merle, he meditated so hard that he cracked the ceiling in a case that might be some type of psychokinesis.
Matt, any other stories of country music you'd like to share with us?
Well, there's I don't know where to you know, I guess, let's see, I guess I should talk a little bit about the Elvis stories, too, because Elvis is a key figure in country music because he's the king of rock and roll, but he actually really had roots in country music. He started out pretty much as a country star, and the one story that always comes up about him is his involvement with the Ryman. And Elvis had tried out for the Grand Ole Opry and was rejected with extreme prejudice from most accounts, and he was told to go back to driving truck. But the story is that, you know, decades later, his daughter, Lisa Marie Presley, had her own singing career, and she was a guest at the Ryman, and she performed at the Ryman. And when she went back to the dressing room, the story goes that she tried to open the door, and it didn't open. She tried the keys, and it didn't open. She got her big, burly bodyguard to try to open the door, and it was as if the door would start to open and then snap back. And so then Lisa Marie got angry and yelled, thinking that there was someone inside, that she was going to call security. And the story goes that they heard a laugh that sounded a lot like Elvis's laugh. The door immediately opens up. They go inside expecting to see someone there, and there's no one there. So that's a good Elvis ghost story. But his presence has also been seen around and felt around Graceland, a couple stories there. The difficult thing about trying to find out whether these are actually ghost stories or just ghost lore is because of Elvis's is unique in music history, because there is a faction that believes Elvis just faked his own death, so he's still around. There are also a lot of Elvis impersonators, so you don't know whether you're actually seeing a ghost of Elvis or maybe just a good impersonator. A lot of Elvis's friends and colleagues wore the same clothes that he did, the same sunglasses. So in one case, there's a story about Elvis's photo, a photo of Elvis's ghost at the pool house after his death on the Graceland estate. But a lot of people have said that that is actually probably one of his friends who just looks, you know, and dresses and has his hair styled like them. So there are all these layers when you get into these ghost stories about Elvis. You're never really sure whether you're getting a real creepy ghost story or just, you know, a story about an impersonator.
Why is it important to you, Matt, to keep some of this history alive?
When I went to a book signing a few years ago, and after the book signing, a lady came up to me and said, you know, first of all, I want to let you know that I don't believe in ghosts. So I thought, I'm going to get blindsided here or something, or I'm going to get yelled at. But she said, but I read your book and I learned so much about rock music history. That was the Haunted Rock and Roll book. And so I came away from that conversation, and I got to discuss some of the stories in the book with her. And I realize now it's important. The one aspect I feel is very important is that it keeps the memories of these artists alive. And it allows their stories to continue to speak. And also there's, I think, with these ghost stories, there's always lessons to be learned about careers and life. So I think whether you believe in ghosts or not, the reason that I find this so important is because it keeps music alive, and it is part of, you know, this. There's an idea, especially in art, about remixing, that you never really create something new. You're always kind of standing on the shoulders of giants. And I think this, if you have these ghost stories around, people are going to become intrigued about the artists, and they'll learn more.
Speaking about keeping things alive, can you give us some history of this Hank Williams song as we go to break?
This was actually his last song that he wrote before he died.
Let's listen to it.
It was his biggest hit.
Going out, Matt Swain. We'll be back with him.
With Paranormal News, I'm John Jeter. In a CIA report that's now declassified, the Russian military says 23 soldiers were zapped into oblivion by aliens after shooting down a UFO.
It made a buzzing sound and a hissing sound. Then it propelled itself in the sky with an explosion.
The aliens survived the shoot down and turned the soldiers into stone, man. Files documenting the March 1993 encounter were buried in documents published online earlier this year. It details a low-flying saucer over a military training unit in Siberia. Ooh, it's cold up there, dude. A soldier fired a surface-to-air missile at the UFO. Out came five short humanoids with large heads and big black eyes. This report comes from two lone survivors. The petrified remains were taken to a secret research institution near Moscow. It's a plane. It's a drone. No, wait a minute. It's a flying bike. Scorpion 3, the world's first hover bike, has been unveiled at the San Francisco headquarters of a Russian startup, HoverSurf. It tops out at just over 30 miles an hour, and it's powered by an electric motor that can keep it airborne for 27 minutes. Engineers used a standard motorbike design. Cool. Sounds really cool, as a matter of fact. Well, if you got 150 grand lying around. Yeah, I wonder if you can use that for, becoming a member of the Mile High Club, man. There really is an app for that, even when it comes to demonic possession. About 20 students in Colombia were playing with a Ouija board app for smartphones and calling out spirits of the dead. Ooh, that's not a good idea, man. Video shows them screaming that the devil is going to take me, and others completely fainting and falling out. They were rushed to a hospital and then taken to a priest. So you still want to play with a Ouija board? I'm John Jeter. Connect with tonight's news at ParanormalRadio.com.
We're rocking the tunes tonight. Matt Swain has been my guest and is still my guest for the rest of this program. His website is MattSwain.com, SWAYNE.com. Author of Ghosts of Country Music, America's Haunted Universities, and a couple others as well. You got to go to his website. And anything coming up for you, Matt? I know you said you're going to keep writing. Do you do public appearances? What's on the horizon for you professionally?
I'm still working on trying to finish up a book about ghost stories and some of the weird Freudian stuff that happened during World War II. That'll probably be my next book project. And then I think I want to come back and revisit Haunted Rock and Roll, maybe do an update to that, I'll go from there.
Can you speak further to the connection between ghosts and music?
Sure. I think that there is a connection between music and supernatural and spirituality, I'll put it that way. And I've really tried, and I'm not a neuroscientist at all, but one of the things that I noticed about music, and I'm kind of an amateur musician myself, is music really requires the whole brain, because it involves creativity, which is typically what's considered a left brain activity, but it also is rooted in mathematics and the frequencies of notes and rhythms. So it also has this analytical aspect. So when you're a musician, you're using your whole brain. And I don't know whether that's part of this connection or not, but all I know is that when you start delving into stories of the paranormal, stories of the occult, you invariably come up with stories about musicians, and especially stories about rock and roll and country music artists. One thing I would say is that the music, the spirituality of haunted rock, of rock and roll is more edgy, more open, and it reflects a lot of the philosophy behind rock and roll, which is this idea of, rock and roll is an outsider's art. It was never accepted. It really kind of never wants to be accepted. Once you are too accepted in rock and roll, become too part of the mainstream, the fans kind of spit you out and they want something new. And so the supernatural stories start to reflect the kind of philosophy that follows these genres. And likewise, I saw it with country music. Besides Bobby Mackey's story. Most of the stories are rooted into traditional stories about the supernatural, about ghost lore, and you know, typical ghost stories that you probably would have found hundreds of years from here.
And you'll find some of these stories as well on our college campuses, won't you, as well, Matt?
You will. And that was, you know, one of my first books that I did with Llewellyn was America's Haunted Universities. And, you know, a little bit of the backstory behind that was that, you know, I was born on Halloween. So I would always, when I was worked as a newspaper reporter, I'd always try to have a really good Halloween feature story. And one year I decided I would do local ghost stories and some local ghost lore. And I found a lot of ghost stories from the area where I was born, but I didn't have enough to really make a complete decent feature story, you know, an 800,000-word feature story. So I remembered going to school at Penn State, and I remembered there were a few ghost stories. So I decided I would try to find some of those stories. And what I found was that Penn State didn't just have one or two that I could remember. There were dozens of stories about ghosts and ghostly encounters on campus. And so over probably the next decade, this was even before the internet, so I couldn't Google things. I would have to wait for stories to move on the AP wire. And when I did, I found that, you know, each year maybe Ohio State college newspaper would talk about their ghost stories, or the University of Ohio, or Georgia. So I started to collect ghost stories from all these college campuses. In the back of my mind, I was always thinking, you know, the university is the place where you go to become more rational, to, you know, learn about science and drop these childish superstitions about ghosts. Why would, you know, college campuses on a, you know, square foot basis have just as many ghosts as a battlefield? I couldn't get my, you know, head around. But over the past, you know, 10, 15 years writing about it and talking about it, I've come to realize that just like ghost stories are important to carry on the traditions of country music and to pass on some of the philosophies of rock and roll and its outsider art image, I find that these ghost stories play important roles on campuses. Whether it's to pass on history and cultural lessons to what I would consider a transitory community, that you have students come on campus and off campus. So stories like Penn State has a kind of a neat but weird ghost story. And the story there is back in the 1857. Penn State was really called the Farm School. And one of the first investments that the university made was in a mule named Old Coley, and he came from Kentucky. And one of Old Coley's job was to haul limestone from a quarry located a few hundred yards from the building that we now on Penn State's campus call Old Main. From this quarry to the original Old Main site to build the building itself. And so as a student at Penn State at that time at the Farm School, you had to pledge so much time of service to the university. So that might mean working with Old Coley at the quarry to load stones, or it might mean you'd take Old Coley out to a neighborhood farm where you would work with Old Coley. But in any event, throughout that process, the students became really attached to Old Coley, and when he died, they preserved his bones. And so his bones were preserved and then displayed at certain locations around the university from that point on. And over the past almost 100 years, there have been these stories about people hearing the sound of hooves clip-clopping down halls. Some people even say they saw the ghost of Old Coley at a dorm called Watts Hall, and these stories spread throughout the university. Now, I'm not going to say that I believe 100% that there is a ghost of a mule on the Penn State campus, But I want you to start thinking about, in the past minute or two, I've given you a lot of information about Penn State, about how it, the origin of the university. I gave you an idea about the spirit of Penn State students, this idea of service. You know, we recently just had a thon, a dance-a-thon at Penn State called Thon that raised over $10 million for kids with cancer. So if you have a transitory community, I can tell you a ghost story, and within a few minutes, I can pass on ideas about the history, the long history of Penn State. I can talk to you about how important service is to it. Those are what I think make university ghost stories so interesting, and I also think that's probably the reason why, you know, some of these ghost stories have lasted about 100 years, and I think that's also the reason why you have so many ghost stories on college campuses. I'll add that just because we have good ghost lore and good history, ghost stories, actual ghost encounters are also pretty prevalent among the universities that I investigated for that book.
Do you think it's healthy that we have these conversations, and should more universities be, you know, having someone like you, Matt, educating the students?
Yeah, I wish most universities were more open to these stories. I'm very fortunate in that Penn State has a pretty relaxed approach to ghost lore. In fact, I think they don't necessarily encourage me to talk about it, but they certainly have never dissuaded me from it. And I think that if universities would be a little more open to this idea of ghost lore and history and community building, I think that would start new conversations about, rather than are there ghosts or are there not ghosts, or, you know, I'm a scientific materialist and you're not, those types of conversations, which tend to be very contentious. I think this brings people together, and we can talk about how important these ghost stories are. The one thing I didn't really touch on is there's also a cautionary tales element to some of these stories. You'll hear stories about roommates who are killed because of violence or domestic violence or you know, pretty brutal things. And a lot of universities might shy away from that. But what I think these stories do is most campuses, college campuses, statistically are some of the safest places in the country that you can be. But I think they're so safe that you might relax your guard a little, because bad things happen no matter where you're at. So what these ghost stories do are they provide the student with cautionary tales to keep their guard up. You know, in Penn State, we have a case of a ghost of a murder victim in Petit Library, and that story lasted decades. But I think that story is really there and is told over and over again, because I think it's a way to make sure people keep their guard up about, you know, dangerous activity.
What is some of the haunted history at Penn State, Matt?
Well, as I mentioned, we have the ghost of Old Coley, Petit Library's haunted. Schwab Auditorium is a theater on campus, and it is rumored to be haunted by a couple different ghosts. One thing I think I could do is I could advise universities that might be reluctant to have ghost stories on campus. I could advise them on how to avoid it, and one way to avoid it is to not have a grave on campus. But Penn State does have the grave of one of the great presidents in Penn State history, which his name is George Atherton. His grave abuts Schwab Auditorium. So he is one of the ghosts that allegedly haunts Schwab Auditorium. And I've talked to several people who have been in the theater late at night and have heard footsteps, have heard bangings, have heard people talking. So it, according to them, is a very creepy place. There was another story that took place probably in the 1980s. A worker in the theater was breaking down one night from a production and said he saw a what he described as a Revolutionary War figure walk from one stage to the other and then right through the wall. And he, you know, went to the press with that, and it's been repeated numerous times. The weird thing is Penn State was created long after the Revolutionary War. So some people, some of the experts there speculate that it was the ghost of a actor involved in a production there at the theater. And he's typically referred to as Schwabu. So the other ghost that apparently haunts Schwab Auditorium is Charles Schwab. And Charles Schwab was, you know, the famous industrialist and...
Oh, I was going to say the investor. That's a different Charles Schwab.
Right. Yeah, it's a different guy. This guy was a partner of Andrew Carnegie. And according to some of the stories that I've heard, Carnegie and Schwab had a falling out. Carnegie built his library on the Penn State campus, which is now used as the building for the College of Communications. And Schwab, maybe in a case of one-upmanship, decided to build his building across the street, catacorner across the street from Carnegie. And there are some people speculate that maybe Schwab haunts the place to keep an eye on Carnegie over in Carnegie building.
What are some of the other campuses around the area that are haunted, Matt, that you know of?
Well, I think, you know, usually every Halloween there's a poll, and Penn State usually comes in second place as most haunted. But the University of Ohio has just dozens and dozens of ghost stories attached to its campus and usually gets the coveted number one haunted hotspot. But they've also done some things that, you know, as a consultant, I would have advised against. And one was the university converted a insane asylum into a building. And so that building has been the center of a few ghost stories that I collected. The South is also a good place for university ghost stories. University of Georgia, University of Alabama all have a few ghost stories, especially ones that, you know, a lot of those universities were involved in the Civil War. And, you know, a lot of those campuses are haunted by ghosts of Union soldiers and Confederate soldiers. So those are also some pretty haunted hotspots in the university world.
And what about areas? Dorms, obviously, we talked about those. Libraries, auditoriums, any particular areas that are haunted more so than others?
All of those, I find ghost stories in just about every type of building on campus, from the libraries. The libraries are libraries you'll find are mostly haunted with the ghost lore type stories. Usually those ghosts are advising students either to study more or to not study so much. Then you have auditoriums, stadiums can be haunted. Dorms especially can be haunted, and those dorms are usually where you'll find a lot of the cautionary tale ghost lore.
If you, we got a couple of minutes left with Matt Swain. 818-672-6865 is our call in number. That's 818-672-6865. And, you can also Skype into the program at Into Paranormal. We've been talking about a whole wide spectrum of stuff tonight with Matt. He is author of Ghosts of Country Music. You can pick that book up on Amazon. We put links up on social media to that as well. Also, America's Haunted Universities is the topic we've been talking about this half hour. If you have a story of a haunted university, let's hear from you. Maybe your university is haunted and you want to share a story. I know we have somebody calling in from Oregon right now. Hello, you're on with Matt Swain.
Hi, great show tonight. Since it's getting kind of late, I was wondering if your fabulous guest would tell us a ghost story. Could be, I don't know, a country music or a college one, perhaps.
Matt?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the call.
She wants to hear a ghost story.
On
She said,
"Would you mind telling us?
Pick one. Whether it's a story about country music or a story about Haunted University. She just wants to hear a ghost story to, I guess, fall asleep to. Can you tell us a ghost story, Matt?
Oh, I thought that's what I was doing the whole time. Well, let me tell you. I'll tell you a ghost story because I wanted to talk a little bit about this. But often there is this case of, you have a lot of ghost lore on campus, and then you have actual ghost stories. So I'll tell you a ghost story that was told to me by a custodian who worked at the Penn State campus. And this was at a building called Old Botany, which is probably Penn State's oldest standing building. And it's right across the street from Schwab Auditorium, which has its own ghost stories attached to it. This guy I was talking to, this custodian, had heard stories about Old Botany being haunted, but never really believed it. And then one night he had the unlucky overnight shift. So this was probably after midnight. He was cleaning up and he was just finishing vacuuming, and he was putting up his vacuum cleaner and unplugging it. And suddenly he heard what sounded like 1,000 glass bottles smashing against the wall, and a complete ruckus happening. So he felt that the building was being broken into. He ran to the building to see what was going on. As soon as he opened up the door, the noises completely stopped. It was completely silent. And the odd thing was, there wasn't even any glass in that room. It was more of office space. And while Old Botany was a laboratory, you know, maybe 100 years ago, it wasn't at that point. And in fact, later, through some investigation, this janitor told me that he found out that that room did have a laboratory, and probably was full of beakers and test tubes and whatnot. So from that moment on, he said he started to be a believer, and for the next 5-10 years, he had experiences pretty routinely there. He had a rug or carpet roll up in front of him. It was just a lot of weird things happening. I hope that works as a ghost story.
Matt, fabulous stuff tonight. Best to you. I appreciate you coming on the program.
Thank you very much. I always have a lot of fun.
And we have a lot of fun having you as well. That is Matt Swain, author of Ghosts of Country Music and of America's Haunted Universities. His website is mattswain.com. And from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, I will say goodnight to you here on this Saturday. We'll be back. We'll gather once again in 1 week's time for my 200th episode, when Preston Dennett is right here with more true accounts of UFO and ET contacts. My best to you. Good night.